Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you doing today?
I am just grand. I'm just grand. And I know that we want to talk about what everyone in the restaurant world is talking about this week. It's the review of Guy Fieri's place in the New York Times.
You know how you know everybody's talking about it?
How? When you get 20 emails from listeners and friends, with an hour when the Times goes out online at 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night?
How I know is I was watching Anthony Bourdain give a mainstream interview on his, he's doing the Kitchen Confidential. He's updated it with like pages, notes in the borders with updates like
he's so smart.
Like you can eat fish on Mondays now. Go ahead and he uses a.
He's
a,
so
a
smart.
Swear word, and says, "Go ahead and order effing fish on Mondays."
He's so smart.
He's really smart.
Bourdain's cool.
So anyway, he's on doing an interview about his book, right?
Yeah.
Except they spent half the time talking about the Pete Wells interview, Pete Wells review of Guy Fieri's restaurant in Times Square.
For those of you who've been living under a rock, Pete Wells is the reviewer for the New York Times. And he's a very good writer, and he's a pretty good reviewer. And Guy Fieri is the host of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. He has a bunch of restaurants already. We're out west or down south. I only know him from his show. Never eaten in the man's restaurants. I got nothing against him. I like his show. I like his personality. It's in the show, if you haven't seen it, is this, like, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. It's kind of a blue-collar, no-collar food, and it's sort of interesting, you know?
Yeah, places you would go around the country and...
Yeah, on a road trip.
And fry things.
He did Rutt's Hut. Didn't he do Rutt's Hut?
I don't know.
I think he did Rutt's Hut up in North Jersey, a hot dog place.
I don't know. Maybe you watch more TV than I do.
I don't think so, but I... So Guy Fieri, who owns these, you know, real down-home places where it's kind of kitschy, but, you know... Well, and he's a celebrity chef. He opens up something that doesn't really seem like it... would fit with his personality or what he does. He opens up a 500-seat restaurant. Mark, have you seen the place?
I have not seen
500
the place.
Seats right on Times Square.
Just pictures.
It was the old Heartland Brewing Company on Times Square. Mm-hmm. It was huge, right? And the place, from every review I've read of it, sucks so bad, right? It sucks really bad. So everyone has reviewed this place poorly. And, you know, Mark and I were commenting about how, you know, maybe... We were wondering if he maybe just licensed his name or somehow we lost control of this because everyone writes really bad things about it. But the pièce de la résistance of terrible reviews was Pete Wells' review last Wednesday in the Times. He gave them a poor. Now, for those of you that don't know, the Times used to, I don't know if they still do, they used to explain what the stars mean. One is good, two is very good, three is excellent, and four is extraordinary. So satisfactory is zero. You know what that makes poor?
Minus one.
Minus, you're underwater. I haven't seen a poor review. I don't remember. You know what?
Oh, I can't remember.
I remember what the last, it was when we first started doing the radio show. It was the Ninja restaurant.
I remember the Ninja.
That was the last poor I've seen. And well deserved, by the way.
I felt that this review was too personal.
You know, I think that we have both refined our position since we last discussed it, because you said before you felt it was a personal attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are elements of that in here. And I said, you know what? It sounds like this food is an insulting ripoff. It sounds like, you know, rip off the tourists in Times Square. And so there's no doubt that Pete Wells was angry. I mean, that the food went beyond, hey, they were trying and this is
very good.
Well,
I think it wasn't just food. It was food. It was service. It was... everything about the place, that he felt the place maybe was too big, it was too big for its britches, was owned by a celebrity chef who wasn't living up to the stuff that he's saying on his show.
Exactly. And see, what I think, and look, we have a radio show and we have a restaurant, so we know what that's like to people say, hey, this, you know, you got to live up to what you got to walk the walk, right? You got to walk the talk. I can understand why the things he legitimately mentions here, I can understand why it would make him mad. You know, in restaurants that rip off people, it can make you mad. Restaurants that don't promise what they deliver, that doesn't seem to be a mistake.
Don't deliver what
make
they promise,
mad.
Yeah.
Right, that's what I meant. So here are some things, though, but upon rereading it, Mark, I think you're right. I think it went too far. I think Pete Wells went too far, like you said. It was too personal. He writes in a second paragraph, Pete Wells writes, "Did panic grip your soul as you stared into the whirling hypno wheel of the menu, where adjectives and nouns spin in a crazy vortex? When you saw the burger described as, and this is a menu item, Guy's Pat LaFreda custom blend all-natural Creekstone Farm black Angus beefed patty, LTOP, which stands for lettuce, tomato, onion, and pickle, SMC, which stands for super melty cheese, and a slathering of donkey sauce on a buttered brioche." And that's a little much. And then he hated it when it came out, you know. So I think that that's a valid criticism.
I totally agree. See, and criticisms like that of, hey, your menu description was too long and dumb.
Right. And then he says, did you notice the menu overall was an unreliable predictor of what actually came to the table? Also something to legitimately be mad about. Mm-hmm. Were the bourbon butter crunch chips missing from the Almond Joy cocktail? They were in mine. Was your deep-fried boulder of ice cream the size of a standard scoop of ice cream? And what exactly about a small salad with four or five miniature croutons makes Guy's famous Big Bite Caesar A, big, B, famous, or C, Guy's in any meaningful sense? I think that's fair. I think those criticisms are fair. But what I will say is, you know, he gets personal where he says some point later in the review, and one of the phrases that Guy Fieri uses on his show is Flavortown. Mm-hmm. And so he writes, is this how you roll in Flavortown? And what I realized when I read that is this is a letter to the owner of the restaurant.
This is a letter. This is a scathing letter to the owner of the restaurant.
And it says, screw you, you bastard.
And it's over the top. Yeah.
And it's over the top.
And it's personal. And yeah. It's not. I didn't like what you did, or what the people you hired did, or what the people who licensed your name did,
or to say you failed,
or even to say, you know what, you get an F for today,
or even overall. The thing is, it shouldn't be you get an F for today. This is a letter to Guy Fieri. Mm-hmm. That's what's wrong with it. That's what sends it over the line. You know, and he writes about the donkey sauce. And he says two things. One is a valid criticism, and then the other is take it too far. So I've come over to your point of view on this. I think the restaurant probably
should. Like most things, you get there eventually.
You're very wise, fellow.
You just need some time to see the wisdom of my ways.
I think the restaurant probably should have gotten a pour. And I think that most of these things he pointed out are legitimate. But for example, he says, what accounts for the vast difference between the donkey sauce recipe you've published and the donkey sauce in your restaurant? That's a fair criticism, man. That's totally fair. But then the next paragraph he says, and when we hear the words donkey sauce, which part of the donkey are we supposed to think about? Too far. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
You know, it's all, like I said, very, very personal. It's all directed at, this is a letter to Guy. It's directed at Guy.
And it's insulting.
That's an insulting letter to Guy.
And let's just take this out, because like you said, there are several other things in here. And when we hear the words donkey sauce, which part of the donkey are we supposed to think about? That's not criticism. That's an insult.
Mm.
And I don't think the New York Times should be out there insulting people.
I agree.
I will say I heard Guy Fieri's response, and a lot of the stuff that's going on in this restaurant, we've heard from this, and also realized we've read six other reviews of this restaurant that say the same thing.
Well, they don't say it like this, though.
Right. No, they point out the flaws, and that service
is not any better.
But Guy was interviewed recently in his response, and I don't know what I would do if I were him. I would feel terrible. But he said it was a really kind of a lame answer, and he said something like, well, you know, they're the New York elites piling up on a non-New York chef. I'm like, nobody's really from New York. I mean, every chef in New York is from someplace else. That's not really the case. But I think it's personal, and it's insulting, and you've convinced me, Mark. You've convinced me.
And if I were Guy, I would be personally insulted, and I'm not sure how I would react.
And if I were Pete Wells, I'd be afraid of Mark Pascal coming over and punching you in the nose. No, I wouldn't.
If Guy Fieri punched Pete Wells in the nose,
that would be awesome.
Okay, so Guy, if you're listening, we are encouraging you to punch Pete Wells in the nose.
I'm not wishing any ill on Pete Wells, but they would both get totally famous and make a lot of money. Don't punch him too hard. Just go punch him a little bit.
I think one of them is already making a lot of money.
Well, you know what's funny is Guy said something when he talked about the liberal Northeast not liking a guy from New York. He said something like, you know, Pete Wells is trying to make a name for himself by criticizing Guy Fieri. Guy? He's the New York Times restaurant critic. He doesn't have to make a name for himself.
Okay, but one of them is making a ton of money, And one of them is a writer for the New York Times and probably doing okay.
I don't think Pete Wells is poor.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But I think he's mad. Well, I think the rating is probably justified, but I have never seen, and that's exactly it, I've never seen a restaurant review as a letter to the owner, and maybe we're a little more sensitive to this because we own a restaurant.
And I get letters, and I don't like when I get nasty letters. When I get, here's the difference, and I'll tell you, and I guess this is,
I know where
you're
going
with reacting this way. If I get a letter and you say, hey, these things went wrong, and I was really counting on having a great meal, and your organization let me down. Wow, wow does that hit me?
We'll do anything to get
okay.
you back to make
wow,
it
does
right.
that hit me? When I get a letter and say, you stupid donkey, I can't believe what your restaurant and what you did and how could you be so arrogant as to whatever, blah, blah, blah,
and
blah,
the line,
blah.
And the line that really gets us is, and I have told all of my friends and I've gone in her, and I'm like, you didn't, I am a person. Mm-hmm. And I make mistakes sometimes. And if you send me a letter saying, hey, you know what? We came in expecting good dinner and it was lousy. And we'll try and fix it. Mm-hmm. But if you send me a letter saying, you know, I had a lousy meal and so I've tried to destroy your business. I have tried to tell everybody I know never to go there again.
Here's the part of it that really I think gets lost sometimes. Insults. I have problems with the insults. That's exactly what I have.
So listen, we're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna come back on the other side, and we're gonna go to an interview that I had with a guy named Bill Woolsey. Bill owns 50 bars, 3 hotels, and a couple of pizza joints in Northern Ireland. He's probably the most successful restaurateur in Northern Ireland, and he's the proprietor of the Merchant Hotel, which is one of the best hotels in...
You've heard
in
Francis
UK.
Talk about
yeah,
it a bazillion
it.
Times.
And I had never met him before, but he... I've been getting a little bit involved in Belfast, and Mark and I have been helping them with their restaurant week and the like. So he agreed to meet me for breakfast in his own place. And let's go have a listen.
I am talking to you today from one of my favorite bars in one of my favorite hotels in all the world. I am talking to you from the room with the cocktail bar at the Merchant Hotel, and I have the great good fortune to be joined by the proprietor of this fine establishment, Mr. Bill Woolsey. Bill, welcome for the show.
It's a delight to be on the show. It's a delight. You're in Belfast with the sun shining as well.
I know. I didn't bring it. It's not my fault. I can't take any credit for it. I wasn't exaggerating at all a moment ago in the introduction when I said this is really one of my favorite hotels, and it is certainly one of the most unique bars in all the world. And I run a couple of places in New Brunswick, New Jersey, right? And one of the things that I like to hear when people walk out of my joint in Central Jersey, I love it when people say, you know, that was really great. What are you doing here? You know, how did you get here? What is this place doing here? And I had the same exact reaction when I walked into your place for the first time. So now I get to ask you directly, what are you doing here? What is this place doing here?
With a five-star hotel?
Yeah.
In Belfast. Well, Belfast is a reasonable size, a capital city.
Uh-huh.
And before I opened the hotel, I was really a publican. I consider myself now
a
publican.
I love that word, by the way.
Yeah, publican, yeah. And we were getting rid of the bad times, the troubles that we had.
Yeah.
And our most famous hotel was famous for being blown up.
Yeah, the Europa.
The Europa. So I decided there would definitely be a market that would deal with sophisticated individuals like yourself.
Oh, please.
Yeah. And somewhere that the local population would be proud of. It's the same when you open a pub.
Sure.
If you can get a pub or a restaurant that people empathize with and feel proud of, then that is really the foundation for any success. So what I wanted at the time, if you remember those days when property people were king, I had to try and compete against them. So what I wanted to do was find a building that was listed, heavily listed, grade A, and that put off the property people. But I also knew that was an opportunity for to have a building that nobody could piggyback on my idea.
Right.
So from a business point of view, this building made a lot of sense. It was the headquarters of the Ulster Bank, and as you can see, it's a beautiful, beautifully ornate Victorian building.
Was it an abandoned bank when you took it, or was
it hadn't been used for 3 years, but the bank had not let it fall into a state of disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I needed to do was remove all traces of banking.
Yeah.
There's banking and...
unsexy.
Unsexy.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't lay a good image in anybody's mind.
Sure.
So we don't... I mean, I'm really proud of the fact that nobody refers to this as a bank anymore. They forget about it. We have individuals that come in and say, I used to work here 30, 40, 20 years ago, so that's great, and they come in and have a good look around. But by and large, it looks like Grand Hotel, which is what we decided from the get-go.
And when you initially opened, you were, what, 20-something rooms? It was a real boutique hotel.
Yeah, we had 26 rooms. 21 rooms and 5 suites.
And the centerpiece of the hotel is the grand dining room,
yeah,
as you would call it. Is that what you call it?
The great room. Yeah.
You know, I've seen great rooms before. Yeah. It's a great, great room.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it was... I'm convinced this bank was... When it was built as a bank, mm-hmm, it was put out to tenders. So there was four architects.
When was it built?
1870, I think.
Sure. So high Victorian.
Yeah. And I'm convinced that the man who won it knew it was going to be converted to a hotel one day. He really wanted to design a hotel because it divided so beautifully. Mm-hmm. This office, the cocktail bar that we're sitting in, was, you know, a huge room, and, you know, it divides perfectly. The great room where the restaurant is a beautifully over-the-top Victorian room.
And that was the central lobby of the bank, I assume?
It was, yes. Yeah. That was the main bank.
So that soaring ceilings, how tall is it to the center of the dome?
I would say it must be, you know, 80 feet.
Yeah, an 80-foot ceiling. You can add a little bit of majesty to it.
It's, you know, and then the beautiful... you know, the stained glass centerpiece, mm-hmm, and then the beautiful carvings round the outside.
I have rarely seen something so richly carved. You know, and the other thing that's interesting about it for those who are coming to Belfast to look around, one of the things you really have to see, as boring as this sounds, you've got to go to City Hall and take a look around.
Yeah.
And, you know, the architecture here, especially in the Great Room, is so reminiscent of that gorgeous, beautiful City Hall, which was built a little after this hotel, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think it was 15 years after the hotel. But, I mean, this is, as you say, high Victorian. This is when everything they threw into the buildings.
Yeah.
They wanted
lots of cherubs.
Lots of cherubs, yeah. Lots of very tiny people, and they were determined that anyone coming in here knew that this was a bank of substance.
Yeah, sure.
This is a bank that was safe to leave your money in.
Yeah.
And this is what I hope that people think. This is a safe hotel to leave your money in as well.
Well, it's certainly a safe place to have a cocktail in at the current moment.
Yeah.
Now, I want to tell you the story of how I found this place. I have a dear friend whom I visit whenever I'm in town or in Northern Ireland, my friend Lawrence. And Lawrence... actually now has sort of been converted by your hotel and my prodding to be into cocktails. But Lawrence and I have ridden motorcycles across America together. And Lawrence would have been more beer, whiskey, wine person.
Yeah.
But he knew that I was into cocktails. Now, what year was it that you opened?
We opened 7 years ago.
So, was 2000 and what?
2005 or something like that.
And what month was it?
God knows. As a blur.
You know, I don't remember myself exactly the month, but that year I came in and I was visiting family down, and I got off the train from Drogheda, and Lawrence picked me up, and it was the middle of the afternoon on a weekday, and he said, listen, I got some place I want to show you. And I said, okay, and I've been to Belfast many times before. And I walked in the door, and I thought... what is this place? How did this? And then I sat down at the bar, and Hayden Lambert, who is still in your employ, and we'll talk about retention in a moment.
Yeah.
And Hayden Lambert was behind your bar, and that's when I met Hayden, who's since become a friend. You know, and he was a really knowledgeable cocktail person who could also execute and make great cocktails. And it was the middle of the afternoon, so we had him to ourselves for a couple of hours, and we had your lovely cocktail bar pretty much to ourselves for a couple of hours, and just. Absolutely blew me away then, and you know I've come back at least every year or 18 months since.
Well, you know, there's an obvious thing there that you could say, why not? Is this place in Belfast?
Sure.
You know, Belfast deserves a place. This as much as any other city. There's you know a reasonable, a good level of sophistication in Belfast. Mm-hmm. So I'm as proud of this hotel as I can be. This year we won the UK Hotel of the Year award, Bloomsburg, and I mean that was the first time that had come to Ireland.
Yeah.
Never mind Northern Ireland. So we were proud of that. But I mean, I think that and I said earlier, anything you do, you should do the very best of what you do.
Sure.
As long as you understand what market you're aiming for. Right. And that is what we've done here. So I think after 50 years of troubles, we've now decided that we all love each other. We're a peace-loving nation. And you know, it's good that hotels like this can survive. I mean, one of the things I have said, I heard you mention Hayden. I've been lucky enough, when I was setting up this hotel, I visited lots of, you know, the best hotels I could. I went to Claridge's in London. I went to the Connaught in London. I went to the Maurice, the Plazzatini. I went to the Carlisle in New York. You know, I started to study what was a good hotel and what made a great hotel. And, you know, it was the same thing that I'd learnt nearly 35 years ago as a publican. And it's something that I tell my staff over and over and over again. It is them. It is them that make. Yeah. You know, I've travelled, as I said, to some of the best places in the world. I've forgotten the decors of them. There's some distant memory, but I always remember that. I always remember that concierge who went that one step further.
Sure.
That cocktail barman who told me of a really good club to go to and a bad one, you know, to avoid, or that the waiter who went. You always remember the people, and that's what I think we're most proud of here.
Furniture, glassware, windows, beautiful buildings, they're just tools.
Yeah.
And if they don't have people to animate them, they're tools that are left, you know, they're like weapons left on the battlefield. It doesn't, they don't do anything. I view it as a similar thing to what you say and what your staff does very well. I think that, you know, people don't come here because they need a bed to sleep in. There are cheaper beds in Northern Ireland, the cheaper food, and you can get a drink anywhere. Maybe the food's not as good, maybe the bed's not as nice, but people come to the merchant to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what you're selling, right?
I mean,
people walk out and say, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
And how you get there, well, you know, that's the people. And, you know, you give your people these wonderful tools to get there, but that's the goal, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's the tool. It's the experience.
Yeah.
The experience of coming here, feeling they've got value and money, and walking away with memories. And that's what we like. And also in this hotel, we have high levels of sophisticated people. We have, you know, top-end travellers, and we have a lot of top-end business people.
Sure.
But we especially reach our arm out for those who we know look nervous when they come in. The staff are told to spot this.
Sure.
So this could be a special occasion. We do over 1,000 afternoon teas here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the amazing amount of afternoon teas. So we get grandmothers bring granddaughters bring grandmothers.
Sure.
Mothers bring daughters, and on it goes. But for a lot of people, this is a big expense.
Sure.
And we go out of our way to wrap our arms around those people. And it's all those type of things make a really great hotel or a great business.
Bill, I've known you for 10 minutes, and I love you, man. What do you say is so important, and I have one restaurant that's sort of, you know, upscale casual, and one restaurant that is frankly pretty expensive. And what I say to my staff at staff meal very often, I say, you know, here's who's coming here tonight. We have a collection of people who can dine like this every night and think nothing of dropping $500 or $1,000 on a bottle of wine. And those people can have their driver take them anywhere they want to go, but they've chosen to come here, so we'd better be good. And the other people we have coming in tonight are the people who saved up all month because this is their one night out, or maybe this is the best dinner all year, this is their anniversary. And you have a moral obligation to make sure that they have a great time, too. And so, on the one hand, the stakes are high because, well, they can go anywhere they want. And on the other hand, the stakes are high because, that's a great responsibility. And you just said the same thing.
Exactly. So, exactly.
So let's turn the conversation to cocktails for just a minute. Because
you
opened in 2005. Now, the cocktail revolution, I mean, it was incubated by Dale DeGroff in 1991. It really came to
1891.
The cocktail renaissance, we'll say. Sorry, 1991. It really came to the fore in New York in 2000, London in 2000, and it was kind of confined to those cities for a while. And you were really at the forefront of the cocktail revolution. London was just sort of coming online in 2005. And a lot of people didn't understand cocktails. I mean, handmade cocktails from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's ubiquitous now in fine dining, in especially in the UK, Ireland, and the United States. But when you were doing it, I mean, people didn't even know people who had not left Northern Ireland had never seen that before. You were the first to do real cocktails in Northern Ireland. What made you take that chance? What made you decide that you needed to do that?
Because I had witnessed that in the other great hotels, and I wanted to make sure I had all the pieces in place.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a very talented cocktail manager who came along to us.
Sean
Muldoon.
And Sean is going to open the Dead Rabbit in New York City.
In New York, yeah. And Sean was passionate about cocktails, and he came along, and we sat and talked for an hour. And my great terror as being a publican was I love seeing a bar absolutely full, and I love seeing people fight for space practically.
Sure, sure.
And what I was then having to take on board was sure we would be charging a price that reflected the product and
sure.
and the wages and the skills that
and the amount of time it takes
and
to make
the amount
one of those
of time
cocktails.
That goes into it. But it was my fear of having somewhere where people couldn't actually stand. We have a no standing policy here, so you can stand around the bar, and when the seats are taken, the bar is closed until somebody leaves.
Sure.
So I had to take that mode, but it was more. I had witnessed this in the other great hotels, and Sean impressed me with his total, you know, dedication to what he could perform, what he could put in.
Sure.
And he convinced me that he could make this a success. And indeed it has been a success year on year, the turnover's gone up.
Well, let's talk about the success in terms of the current economic downturn.
You have
the top end hotel in Belfast, which is the capital of Northern Ireland. And let's talk in terms of all Ireland. I mean, you have one of the nicest hotels in all of Ireland. And frankly, it's right up there with the other great hotels of the UK, like the Connaught that you mentioned. You're doing well. And you continue to do well and, in fact, expand in the face of economic contraction without, from everything I've read, much government assistance or incentive. How the heck are you doing that?
With no government assistance, with no government grants at all, because we're in Belfast, if we're out in the bog ends and over, I think we would get a little bit of a grant, but we've had no grants. I think, obviously, when I opened it, I didn't realise we were going to enter into one of the deepest recessions, certainly in the last 50 years, and that I didn't know. But because, what can I do? We have to go on, have to do our very best. And when the economic downturn got deeper and deeper, we did think our turnover would decline. But what we find is that individuals are prepared to spend the money, and they will spend it on the very best. They may not go out as often, but we've picked up on the back of that. So our restaurant that gives superb service and excellent food
sure.
has picked up a lot of those special occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And the cocktail bar that we're sitting in and we're so proud of continues as well, because people, and despite how gloomy things are, want to give themselves a treat.
Well, it's a 15-pound vacation. You know, the cocktail is a 15-pound vacation or a 12-pound vacation.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
I mean, again, you said about the opening. You know, when I looked at the price we would have to charge to get a margin, you know, I was terrified. I'm hardly a drinker at all.
Sure.
I drink a couple of beers. So.
Yeah, me too. Oh, wait, no, that's not correct.
So, I was frightened of all those things, but the cocktail bar has been a success, and the Great Rim Restaurant has been a success, and continues to be a success. Almost, it defies the gloom that's going on.
Sure.
Listen, people can be gloomy for so long.
But
we all like to go out and have a bit of crack.
Sure, yeah.
And
it's funny. We opened our cocktail bar. We've been doing cocktails since 1993 when Dale DeGroff, who I know you know, helped us start our cocktail program in 1993 at Stage Left. But we opened Catherine Lombardi with a dedicated cocktail bar, you know, with enough room back there to make cocktails and have a Garde Manger station almost behind your bar. And we were in a town where the average cocktail price was $8 or $8.50, and we had to charge $12 in order to make less than the guy charging $8 saw as a margin. And people said, "Oh, $12 for a cocktail," and that's New York prices. I'm like, there's three guys behind the bar.
They paid.
That's what they need to be paid. And the ingredients that go into it don't come out of some gun in a big tank in the basement.
Yeah.
Was there price resistance when you first opened it?
No, there wasn't, because I mean, the cocktails are superb.
They are.
It's easy for me to say, but it is. I mean, and the cocktail bar where we're sitting has won award after award after award.
Let's talk about that, because I met some of your staff down in New Orleans in the two consecutive years that you took away some of the top awards at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans, where we broadcast from several times.
Yeah.
You won Best Cocktail Menu, Best Hotel Cocktail Bar, Best International Bar, and then you have three awards? Or
we won four awards.
What's the fourth award?
I can't remember that. I know we won four awards.
It's funny because I was in the airport and I saw some of your guys the next morning and they had the glass plates and they were carrying them unwrapped. And it was like, you need to wrap those. If you break that, Bill Woolsey's going to be very upset when you get back to
the fourth award was probably for their hangover.
It was monumental. There were a lot of great hangovers going on down there. Hey, listen, Bill, we need to take a short break. Will you stick with us and just come back on the other side and have a brief chat to close us out?
Yeah.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take back to New Jersey, and we'll be back in Belfast in just a moment.
Wow, that was great, Francis. So Bill talked a little bit about the importance of the people in the place and how you remember the people in the place. You know, I remember going to Elaine Ducasse. I remember the waiter who guided us through the menu.
I remember his name. That was a decade ago, and his name was Umberto.
Umberto was his name, exactly right. And I remember him guiding us. I remember him after lunch taking us into the parlor room, and everybody else had gone, and spending 25 minutes with us talking about the history of the restaurant and how their philosophies.
It was at Elaine Ducasse when it was at the old place, the old Bocuse Hotel.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it really, that struck me, and the service in that restaurant struck me as much as the meal in that restaurant, which was one of the top five meals of my life.
Yeah.
And I think Bill hit on that and really, really made you understand what it is.
And anything delivered in that gentle Irish accent to Americans, and it just seems nicer. You could be telling you to go screw yourself, and it just, would you go screw yourself now? No, fine.
You don't say go screw yourself, though. You say go take a walk around the park and lift up a tree.
I love when you try and come up with the Irish expressions. You know, I love that. And I'm not going to share any with you right now because we need to go for a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're going to go right back to my interview with Bill Woolsey at the Merchant Hotel from earlier this fall. And he talks a lot about, in the upcoming segment, we talk about a little bit about what it was like to build a business in Northern Ireland, because he started his businesses there before the current peace, and what it's been like to grow with Belfast. Pretty interesting stuff. So let's take a listen.
So we're back having a cup of tea at the cocktail bar in the Merchant Hotel with Bill Woolsey. Listen, you are not a sponsor of this radio show. I don't say that if you're in Belfast, you should come and stay at the Merchant Hotel. I say if you're anywhere in the UK or Ireland, you should make a trip to Belfast so that you can stay at the Merchant Hotel, have some cocktails in the bar, and then go and listen to some music or do some of the other great stuff that Belfast has to offer. Belfast was a troubled city for a long time. I mean, my family is originally from Northern Ireland, and you know, I've been coming here for many years. I always remember I was walking with my friend Lawrence. Oh God, this must have been the early mid '90s, and we were walking by the Europa Hotel, which you mentioned before, that's the largest hotel in Belfast.
Yeah,
right?
One of the largest.
And we were going to the Crown Bar, and my friend Lawrence, and he was a very intelligent fellow. He always says to me, he said, "You see that hotel over there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "It's the Europa Hotel." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, that has the distinction of being the most bombed hotel in all of Europe, because this was before Sarajevo." And he said, "You know, Lawrence, why is it that I feel when I'm walking with you that I've got a target on my back. And he said, Francis, don't be ridiculous. The target's on my back. You'll be killed by the shrapnel. So we've come from there, from a very troubled city with an unstable business climate, you know, with a lot of great people in Belfast. But the people were afraid for a long time. I mean, the carpets rolled up to at 10 o'clock at night in the weeknight. There's nobody on the streets. And now we have a peaceful environment, and we have people who are working very hard. The good people of Northern Ireland are working very hard to maintain a peaceful environment. And guess what you get with that? You get, you know, business opportunities, and people can invest, and, you know, your quality of life can go up. But you didn't start. You didn't wait for the good times to start doing business in Northern Ireland. How many pubs do you?
I have 50 pubs.
50 pubs.
50 pubs.
You're a very small country.
Yeah, and a very small country, and we have 3 hotels and 4 pizza restaurants, which are probably the quickest expanding thing we have.
When did you? Can you tell me the story of when you opened your first pub? I know that you borrowed money from your folks,
yeah,
who were not wealthy people.
No, my mum, we come from a housing estate in one of the poorer areas.
That would be in America, for America, that subsidized housing, low
income
housing.
Yeah, one of the toughest areas. But I had two fantastic mother and father,
uh-huh,
who believed at the time that education was the big thing, but I was a huge disappointment,
uh-huh,
as you can hear by my inarticulate ramble here.
Not at all.
And so I had really great parents, too, both very strict socialists,
uh-huh,
which they were way ahead of their time and in all things. Didn't even believe in nationalities. Thought that our troubles, this Catholic Protestant thing, was the biggest lot of nonsense ever. So we were brought up with a very liberal background.
Sure.
And what happened was, my first career, I was a professional footballer. I played football for a while, and
mm-hmm,
that didn't work out. And then I got into this industry, and I started to work in the hospitality industry. And we lived in England at the time. We'd moved over to England because of the troubles.
Sure.
And there was an opportunity to buy a pub back in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. In Belfast?
In a place called Bangor, which is,
sure,
12 miles from,
right,
Belfast.
Sure.
And the price was 120,000, and it dropped from 120 quite rapidly down to about 50,000. And my mum and dad did an amazing thing, because I was 21, 22. They lent me their life savings,
jeez,
which is around £9,000, and I had £3,000 of my own. And I had great references from a boss I had in England,
mm-hmm,
and a bank manager took a real gamble on what was a 21, 22-year-old kid. And what I didn't realize was I was so keen to get into, you know, running the business, that I didn't realize why it had dropped from 120 to 50.
Oh, please tell me why. And I love these stories.
The reason it had dropped is, our euphemism for it is, the boys had taken over.
Oh.
So, it was an absolutely terrifying period for us. We closed for some time. What actually happened is the police came round and said to us, look, special branch.
Right.
Came round and got my father and myself and said, you're going to have to keep him out. He's this organisation. You're going to have to keep him out. He's that organisation. He's done this. He's done that.
Oh, God.
You know, he's killed him. And it was a really terrible time. And my father and I decided that what we would do is we wouldn't take the police's advice. We would let everybody in, and we would bar them for breaking our rules.
Okay.
And it turned out to be one of the scariest times, but probably the best decision we ever made.
Sure.
So we weren't barring anybody because it belonged to this or that. And as you can imagine, I was saying to somebody, look, I'm not serving you. And they would ask why, and I told them they were swearing or they were...
So what were your rules? What were the rules that they were
breaking? Well, the rules, we didn't allow any swearing. We didn't allow any sectarian talk.
Uh-huh.
We didn't allow in any shirts that belonged to particular football teams. And this was unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, 35 years. So I would get someone say to me, do you know who I am? And I would know who they were. I would know what dreadful deeds they committed.
Right.
But, you know, I learnt more in that bar in 6 months than I've learnt in the last 35 years of my life.
What's your life on the line there?
Well... It sounds melodramatic, but there's some. I was stabbed in that bar eventually, but every single penny of my mother and father had given me was wrapped up in that bar, and
mm-hmm,
I was not going to pay any money out to anybody for their so-called protection.
So did people try and extort protection?
They what they do is they angle themselves round, and you know they don't come up and say it. They angle themselves into a position that if there's a fight, they can help on that, and they could maybe give you a door team and
that's help you don't need,
that sort of thing. And once you start, that is a slippery slope. So we didn't take any of that. But what I did learn is there are far more good people in the world than bad. And a lot of people knew my father from his trade union days.
Sure.
And these were the parents of these boys, let's call them that.
Right.
And they knew my father as being a good and honourable man. And eventually they even got to like me.
Uh-huh.
So the community wrapped themselves around us and they said, like give them a break. And we very quickly, from the first days, we put money into sponsoring football matches,
sure,
boxing clubs.
Sure.
If anyone had there was a couple of robberies at old people's houses, we quickly ran functions. So we became part of the community very, very quickly, and other people weren't doing that.
Right, sure.
Other publicans weren't doing that.
Sure.
But we weren't paying anybody.
Right,
And from that, you know, we were able to expand. So I have pubs both sides of the divide, and we're known as being straight down the middle.
So I don't want to dwell on it, and we don't have to go there if you don't want. But what were the circumstances in which you were stabbed in your own bar?
It was a evil character, let's put it that way. He was well known to one particular organisation, and I had refused to serve him. And he had made a point of what he was going to do, and other individuals in the bar stepped in and said, you know, give him a break, you know, why are you doing this? And he felt humiliated. And it was, you know, a couple of months later, I was actually on the door, and he came past, and I didn't even see him coming, and he put what is a, we call them stilettos, you know, a very narrow knife, like a
nice pick almost.
Like a letter opener.
Right, sure.
And he just stuck it in my arm. And told me I would remember him, you know, there's something to remember him.
Whatever happened to that man?
He's dead.
Good.
Nothing to do with me. I hasten to add. But I made a point of, you know, went and sounds, you know, melodramatic and mafioso, but I made a point of making sure I worked the rest that night. There was nothing.
That's not melodramatic.
They were bad days, but, you know, the people in Northern Ireland craved peace way ahead of the politicians.
Sure.
And over the 30 years, you know, the vast majority of us have always got on well together.
Sure.
There were some wrongs that needed to be righted, and that has happened. And the politicians have come, you know, in behind the people.
Uh-huh.
The people haven't followed the politicians.
Right.
I don't want to get all dwell on this subject, but I feel we've lacked leadership. And I know because I'm on the ground. I'm a publican.
Right.
I'm a hotelier. I'm a restaurateur. I know I deal with the public every single day. And before this hotel opened, before we actually, you know, there was the peace declarations. Oh, I didn't need a declaration. The people of Belfast, Northern Ireland, didn't need a declaration. We had declared peace a long time ago.
Right.
We lived, both religions lived together.
Yeah.
And I'm proud to come from a country where people are open and broad-minded and friendly. And,
sure.
You know, and have helped each other.
And I don't know the rest of the world and diplomacy, but I do know a little about the situation in Northern Ireland, and I know that in any, you know, where violence comes into play, you know, it's less than 5% of the people would resort to such a thing. And, you know, you may feel one way on an issue or another, but 95% of the people would prefer that no one resort to violence.
Yeah.
Even to in furtherance of an issue an end to which they might agree.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when the people finally stand up and say, listen, we do not accept violence, we do not get behind violence on either side.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you...
We've come a long way from cocktails here.
No, you know what, but we haven't, Bill, because you very specifically use a word that we use all the time, publican. You know, we gave a TEDx talk and we talked about the role of the publican. And, you know, important stuff happens in that third place. And, you know, what you did with your pub and when you talked about creating that space that was safe for everybody to come, that was non-denominational, as it were, and
creating that sense of community. That's what we can do as publicans. That's what, you know, the bartenders listening to this show, the people who run independently operated restaurants and hotels who listen to this show, and we have a lot of folks in the trade who listen. You know, that you make the greatest drink, that you have the best food, that you have a lovely dining room, that's all good, but that's a tool for you to make people happy and for you to bring people together. And people need bringing together, don't they?
Yeah, that's for sure. So, that's for sure.
Bill Woolsey, you do honor to the term publican, and thank you for having breakfast with me this morning.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, I thought that was a really fascinating interview, really fascinating story, really fascinating guy. But, you know, you go back, and now obviously this is, you know, he's going into a really troubled area. And
35 years ago
when it was really, really troubled area, and helping revitalize that. But how many times have we heard a parallel story? Not, again, not quite to this degree, because I'll tell you, I haven't heard a story like this before. But how many times have we heard the story of, yeah, I had almost no money, I borrowed a little bit here, I borrowed a little bit there, and I got somebody who believed in me,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I put my life savings into it, and I worked my tail off, and, you know, forced it to succeed by my will.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the restaurateur, I guess, story, you hear that so much. You just hear that from so many different people. And sometimes it works from generation to generation, but most of the time the restaurateur is a person, a guy, a woman who says, I'm doing this, and I'm gonna make it happen because it's what I want to make happen.
Well, you know, when he said his restaurant, you know, he realized that it's the boys that moved in. You know, mm-hmm. Don't you love Irish sayings like that? Because it means something a hell of a lot more nefarious than that. You know, mm-hmm. you have, you know, people who are going to extort each other. You know, you're in this. Mm-hmm. You didn't want to be the bar of one side or the other. Mm-hmm. You know, which you didn't want to be, and you didn't want to be subject to the extortion or the protection of either side. And, you know, these are people that will kill you. These are people yep. that are killing other people.
Sure.
And he walked the line there so well. But, you know, he took a knife in the arm. And I love that story. We got to talk more about that afterwards. And he doesn't like to dwell on that at all. He likes mm-hmm. to dwell on the positive and on the future, which is great. But he, you know, he was opening the stop. This guy came in and stabbed the knife into his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I had to open. I had to work through it. And he said, that really bought me a lot more. I had decent respect in the community. The people knew we were walking the line. We weren't with either side. We were just trying to be a place for both. But he worked the night with his arm bleeding from a stiletto, and it went to the hospital after the shift. And he said that made a huge impact on a lot of people, made a huge statement.
I remember, I don't know if you remember this. I'm sure you remember it. But I don't know if a lot of... When we opened here in New Brunswick, it was a tough neighborhood. It wasn't Belfast. Okay.
No.
It wasn't Belfast. But one of the things that you and I said was, we need to make our statement. We need to make sure
right.
that everybody here in town and, you know, anybody who would do us harm knows right away that we're not going to stand for it, that we're not, that we're going to be part of this community, and we are going to stake our claim here.
You know, but what we had here was a strong city government.
Absolutely.
And we had
that was behind
law
us.
And the,
not just that,
right.
the strong city government. Strong city government that was behind us.
Right. So kudos to Jim Cahill and the whole administration for the last 20 years. But imagine you're in Northern Ireland and you have two sides fighting against each other. They each claim governmental power. So mm-hmm. the police are on one side of the conflict. Wow. How do you navigate that? What do you do? And, you know, he says all the time, I was there on my own. I didn't get government grants. I didn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the police could cost you the same as not going to the police. So I just have to say, I want to make one analogy, because we do have a friend, a mutual friend, who had a bar in Trenton where she had gangs in the bar. And gangs had taken over her bar where she had invested so much, and her mm-hmm. and her dad, they were trying to run the bar. And these gangs had moved in. They didn't know what to do. Do you remember how she got rid of the gangs? Brilliant lady. Do you remember how she got rid of the gangs?
I remember the story, but no, I don't remember how she got rid of
country music.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She played country music.
It was like Mars Attacks. It was totally like Mars Attacks. She's like, they're like, and she tried everything to get rid of these bars, and there were two different gangs that would occasionally come into a bar, and they're each trying to claim her bar, so it was not even one gang. It was the worst case scenario. And so people come in flying gang colors. She tried to get them to stop. But in the end, like Mars Attacks, it was country music. So.
Well, and let's face it. One of the most difficult things to navigate is having both sides of a conflict in your place at the same time.
Oh.
And hats off to Bill.
And hats off to Waylon Jennings for saving my friend's bar. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as we have. You are listening to the international edition of the Restaurant Guys. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
When I'm calling you.
Don't run, we are your friends.